Hi everyone, it's Danny Chambers here. This is the Veterinary Voices podcast, and I'm here with Malcolm Morley, who is the Senior Vice President of the British Veterinary Association. He happens to only live 6 minutes from me, in Winchester, so we see each other a fair bit. We've been friends a long time. And one thing we've always had is a lot of discussions about this veterinary profession, the challenges that it's facing, and also how much it's changed very quickly, which is one of the reasons we're facing so many challenges when it comes to workforce. Hi, Malcolm.
How are you doing, Danny? Thanks for talking about these things.
Well, we talk about this a lot, don't we? We talk about it sometimes in the pub, sometimes in sort of formal meetings, and we talk about the challenges the RCVS face, me there in council, and the BVA, and how we sort of work together and challenge each other as well. I suppose we could start just by recognizing how much the veterinary profession and the veterinary industry has changed almost beyond recognition in a very short period of time.
Yeah, there's so many changes happened, and I think there are a lot of different areas. And one of the really big issues is the level of teaching we've got at the moment. There have been long-term retention challenges, what BVA has long referred to as the leaky bucket. But what nobody really saw was that not only have we now got a leaky bucket, but somebody turned off one of the taps. We were registering more EU vets into the UK every year than UK graduates. And post-Brexit, post-COVID, we slashed that down to about a third of where it was. So we turned off the taps. We've had pandemic puppies. We've had a huge rise in the number of pets. And then I think we've also got really interesting changes going on with people's relationship with their jobs, people's expectation. You know, I think when you and I first graduated, it was a bit of an era of distress, wasn't it? That, you know, sort of teaism, there was a rite of passage mindset, pretty much unlimited work hours, and, you know, blame on individuals if errors occurred. And so there's a lot of kind of cultural shifts going on as well, and a lot of this happening together.
You're exactly right there. I think you've touched on a few things. Obviously, COVID and Brexit had a huge impact, and also the amount of work that's, you know, 3 million more houses getting lockdown puppies, which is a great time for people to get a puppy when they're at home. But we suddenly had a shortage of vets and more work, and then the difficulty of working through COVID. And it should be, although I think it's over 80% of vets work with dogs and cats, we also had the situation where to export animal products into the EU, then needed veterinary certificates, which was a huge challenge, wasn't it? So that's all happened suddenly. But just taking a slightly longer view, I think there's a sort of sudden generational shift, hasn't there? And two or three different reasons for it, partly government policies and partly the corporatization of the veterinary profession. But for example, you know, there was a point where people would graduate having had a grant to go to university, and then with their veterinary salary alone, they'd expect to be able to buy a house and also buy into a partnership. And then at some point, they might sell that partnership when they retire. Whereas, you know, by the time I came through, we had to have student loans, certain a single veterinary salary you struggled to buy a house in. And for a lot of people, the opportunity of buying into a partnership, certainly at the sort of price it would have done, has changed because corporates are buying up vet practices. So why have people changed the focus of what they want from work? And it's partly generational, as in, you know, younger people have a different view towards work than people of previous generations. But it's also a genuine change in opportunity. Because, for example, if I worked the same hours as someone who graduated a few years before me and worked the same amount of time, I wouldn't be in a position to have bought a house at, you know, twice or three times my salary, and I wouldn't be in a position to sell a practice to a corporate and then retire at 55, even if I did exactly the same hours. So that does change. Like, why should I stay late and do extra nights on call and do all this sort of in lieu work when you're not going to get the tangible benefits from it? Is that something that you pick up on as well?
I think there's a lot of really interlinked things there. I think it's important to say that now probably is a really great time for veterinary entrepreneurialism.
Very true, yeah.
We shouldn't sort of be fatalistic and think that we shouldn't be able to do that. In any industry where there is increased corporatization, there's actually increased opportunities for people to set up individual businesses, do their own thing as well. Yeah. So we've got to recognize that.
I think it's a really exciting project, actually. Some of my friends have, you know, set up their own businesses and own veterinary practices. And yeah, I think there's a desire for the public to have something slightly different and bespoke and independent as well sometimes.
Yeah, I think if we that some of it is perhaps about the demographic of our profession, but it's also about generational expectations of our relationship with work. In the, you know, we now expect that the work needs to fit our workforce, which I think is right, rather than the workforce needs to fit in with that work. I would suspect, although I don't know, that the majority of our profession are second income earners within their household, although I don't know.
I wish that was the case, in my situation, but no, you're right. I guess you're touching on the fact that majority is over 80% of vets who graduate now are female women. What's the percentage of the entire veterinary profession is women at the moment? It must be about 65%, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. And there's some really interesting things there, Danny. You know, we may have a majority of women, but this is far from being a female-dominated profession. And the retention in our female workforce, I think, is particularly an issue. One of the things that's been really impactful for me as a BVA officer is when we started talking about the impact of menopause on our profession. And for two men to be in a podcast talking about menopause, that's probably not something we've done before. So we'll chalk that up for a win for a starter. The veterinary women did some work on that, just looking at the impact of it. For anybody who doesn't recognize the impact in a majority female profession, go back and have a look at the work they did and see how much menopause can have an impact on some of our most experienced and most valued colleagues, really.
We'll certainly share some links to that on this podcast for people want to read up about it. Because you're right, a predominantly female profession. You got to look at all these challenges that affect every individual who's working in the profession. And just touching on that, I know the BVA's Voice of the Profession survey said that 2/3 of vets rate the job-related stress as not good or terrible. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, let's do some of the good bits as well, because actually in that Voice of the Veterinary Profession survey, a lot of it, what stands out is that people really enjoy being vets. So job variety and interest, they rated really high. Job satisfaction, relationship with co-workers, professional and personal development were all really high. So sometimes it's easy to focus on the negatives. It's really important to recognize, though, that the thing that was standout challenging was job-related stress. Yeah, you're right. 2/3 of vets said it's not very good or terrible. 25% said it was terrible. As a BVA officer, as a BVA president, if I thought that our profession was still going to be in that position in 10 years' time, I would think that we had failed to act on something really important there.
And do you have any sort of reading on why were those people saying it was terrible? Were they giving examples? Were there any themes coming up? It's quite a stunt at 25% of people saying it's just terrible stress. Is it time pressures, workload, salaries? What was their main concern?
I think that's such an important and complex question. Stress is something which is the person who's experiencing it can feel it, and what one person feels is stress is different from somebody else. There are very short-term stresses, there are very long-term stresses. I think that we don't have the full answer to that, but I think that we need to look at that figure and use it as a kind of catalyst for change and say, when we've got a leaky bucket of retention, we've got to get to the nub of it. You and I are both first opinion, frontline practicing vets, and we both recognize that working with people who care a lot about their animals, our clients who may have misplaced values, challenges with their expectations, their finances, can be stressful. So, and that's an inherent part of being a vet. But we've got to try and create the workplaces which support people in that kind of challenge rather than just throwing our hands up and saying, this is a stressful job. It's difficult to do anything about it. We've got to find some solutions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big difference, isn't there, between stress and pressure. And pressure can help you perform really well. You can respond to it, and that means you've got the right support network around you, the right training, and in the right environment to do a good job. Whereas stress is often it just feels as though the situation is slightly out of your control, and you're always sort of fighting to catch up or make the best of it. And I suppose, touching on, why people feel stressed, you can do the same as someone who, I have a permanent job now. I've had one for years, but I did locum for many years as well. And I'm the same person, the same personality, the same skill set. And some places were so much more easy to work in, like an absolute joy. And some places you feel like everything's going wrong every day. And I'm the same person, you know. So, and that shows that, you know, if your first job, have a really good example for me actually is that I did a job for covering maternity leave for a year, you know, practice in Aberdeen, which I really enjoyed working in. And to my knowledge, I didn't get a single client complaint that year. I went back to another practice I'd been to before actually, and within the first week, I had 5 complaints. And I was thinking, hang on, literally a week ago, I've gone a whole year without a single complaint. I've now had 5, you know, in 1 week. But it's the
Why
whole.
Is that?
Well, that's what I sort of started to unpack. I mean, I was about 5 or 6 years graduated at the time, so I had, you know, a fair bit of experience. You realize a client sort of journey from the point that they call the receptionist to the way your diary's arranged. So I was doing mainly horses. Being booked in for timings that you weren't possibly going to ever make, which meant that you were technically late. So people are upset that you were late. And then things like the pricing structure, for example, one of the practices was competing with local equine dentists. And so they were offering, I think at the time, that, you know, the tooth rasping was £35. But if you sedated it, it came to about £85. In the practice I'd been at in Aberdeen before, there was a set price, whether you're sedated or not, and I sedate most of them, to be honest, you know, it was a set price for teeth rasping, which included sedation, and the clients were happy with that. So then, you know, I turn up, sedate all these horses, do their teeth, and then the owner gets a bill, and it's more than twice what they had expected. It's those kind of pressures. But I just remember, you know, without going into too many details, it's to do with client management and expectations over a long period of time. You're sort of set up to sort of fail or set up to succeed before you've even had an interaction with the client. If my first job happened to be in the practice where I got 5 complaints in a week, I think I'm awful at this. Everyone hates me. I'm a terrible vet. It's just really stressful. If my first job happened to be the one in Aberdeen where I don't think I got a complaint in a whole year, I love being a vet. Everyone loves me. I'm great at this job. Yet I was the same person with the same experience and the same training. That's the difference between stress and pressure. I'm not saying there's never any stress or pressure in Aberdeen, but you felt equipped and supported to deal with anything that came in. And, you know, how many years have you been graduated now, Malcolm, if you don't mind me asking?
Too long. 30.
But 30. So, yeah, I'm 15. So, you know, I still love being a vet. I absolutely love it. You know, I have seen the difference between practices where you're set up to fail and others where you're set up to succeed. And you must have seen a similar situation in your time visiting different practices.
I think the key thing here is that the great thing is we've got workforce shortage. So actually, there's a real driver to go and work for places where there isn't a penalty for working in those places because you feel unsupported. Mm. What works is often the practices that are working it, they're kind of characterized by the whole system in which you work, aren't they? It's getting to the root cause of that kind of occupational distress that we're thinking about. You shift it away from the individual towards systems, processes, teams, and ultimately the leaders in those practices who create those good veterinary workplaces. And one person who I find really inspirational to talk to is Olivia Ojinska and her whole talking about people, human savvy leadership. That is what we need. And that actually goes to the heart of veterinary businesses at the moment. If you want a veterinary business that is thriving and not struggling to employ people, often there is human savvy leadership. Even in a workforce shortage, there are places that are fully staffed. They've got human savvy leaders, processes, teams that support people.
Yeah, that's very true. I've got a permanent job doing horses, but I do extra weeks of small animal locuming. I give them a shout out. There's Riverside Vets in Eastleigh, Liam Mee, who I love. Great team.
Credit.
Just because I purely love doing the work and I like working with them. So I'll do extra weeks, you know, because I just like working that team. And I wouldn't go and do extra weeks in other places that I didn't want to be at. And that's because of the culture and the way the team support each other and the type of clients they get because they're a nice team and a nice practice. I like what you said earlier about, you know, the problems we face as a profession are sort of the catalyst to change. I think that's really looking at the problems and seeing them as opportunities to improve things. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I don't know about you, Danny, but I am quite change resistant. But you change when you have some kind of external pressure. I think that what we're seeing with veterinary practices and veterinary businesses of all sorts is that if one of their greatest pressures on them is a workforce shortage, it's often the greatest challenge we're facing, then you've got to think about how to retain people above everything else. And if you think about how to retain people, then we're producing workplaces which are reducing that workplace stress, which we know from BVA's voice survey to be one of the greatest challenges about what people think about their job.
So what other big changes are you sort of working on at the moment? You're senior vice president of the British Veterinary Association. You're right in the heart of veterinary politics. And one advantage of being in that sort of position is that people listen to your sort of thoughts on things as well. What are you working on at the moment that you think will be a big change going forward?
Well, BVA is constantly doing so many things. I think one thing that particularly hit out of the blue last year, at the end of this year rather, was at the end of 23, is when the CMA just announced their review of veterinary services out of the blue. I think a lot of...
just for people who don't know, what does CMA stand for?
The Competition and Markets Authority.
So they're investigating veterinary prices, aren't they? There's been an allegation or suspicion that maybe veterinary prices are going up faster than they should be. So they're investigating that. Is that how you'd...
To some extent, the key thing is that it's an informal review at the moment. It's not a formal market investigation. It's really important to understand that the CMA are interested in two things, fundamentally: anti-competitive practices and consumer choice. If you look at the four bullet points that they have got, most of those, they're not about actually, are we making a profit? We have to be able to make profits as veterinary businesses, except for one of them. They're not about chains of practices. A lot of it is about transparency and consumer choice. That was a really big piece of work for BVA, putting in a submission to the CMA review, trying to make sure that it is well-informed rather than ill-informed. I think any profession shouldn't say we don't want any external scrutiny. If you're saying we don't want external scrutiny at all, that's an issue. But what we don't want is ill-informed scrutiny. So that's been a big part. We worked with SPIVs, BSAVA, BVNA and VMG to put in that submission. And it's some really good joint working, I think.
Interesting, yeah. And I guess it sort of touches on, we talk a lot about the Veterinary Surgeons Act being dated to the Veterinary Surgeons Act. It's hopelessly out of date from 1966. But that is one issue, is that the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons can't regulate businesses, only vets. And so you're in a situation now, which is a relatively recent situation, where you can be a vet and your boss is not a vet, and the RCVS can do nothing about them and their actions and their activities, but they can regulate you and your activities. And that does add quite a lot of pressure, or sometimes difficult situations, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. If you go back to that 1966 Veterinary Act, apparently the parliamentary draftsman changed a word, which is that they changed the word person to individual. And person can actually refer to, I think this is right, I think I've got them the right way around, person can refer to bodies as well as individual people. And by doing that, they removed the ability of the college to regulate veterinary businesses at all. Part of the RCVS proposal for legislative reform, just one of many things really, is around mandatory practice standards. And I think we are seeing that where the CMA review is looking at veterinary businesses, that's probably something where parliamentarians will increasingly recognise the need for legislative reform, which as a BVA officer on a daily basis, I see there is a huge need for a new Veterinary Surgeons Act. It's holding us back in so many ways. Just things like recognition of RVNs, protection of the title, regulation of veterinary businesses, a forward-looking fitness to practice regime, which I think people haven't really recognized what that really means, that our current disciplinary process is quite backward-looking and quite punitive.
And it's quite sort of crude, isn't it? You can only strike someone off or not. There's very little in between, and it's not proportionate or particularly helpful, I think, to have to reach such a high threshold to do anything at all, or you have to go nuclear, don't you? And it's not really representative of the sort of day-to-day veterinary life, I don't think.
Yeah, forward-looking fitness practice will be asking the question, are you, Danny Chambers or Malcolm Morley, fit to practice in the future? So yeah. There's many things. And as a BVA officer, talking about legislative reform and championing that need to parliamentarians is something I've spent a huge amount of time doing. So a lot of what we do at BVA, it really interests me. It might not be that exciting, but we are just constantly dealing with things. I mean, at the moment, it's XL bullies, a huge amount of work into lobbying DEFRA over the importance that vets are not typing these animals, even by the back door. So a lot of work has gone into changing the wording.
Yeah, very hot topic at the moment, isn't it? And that's certainly on Vet Voices, it's something that's brought up quite regularly. People potentially getting really worried when an exhale bully is presented to them, either for euthanasia or to be confirmed that it's not an exhale bully. They say that's not really up to the vet to have to make that decision about whether it qualifies as an exhale bully or not, is it?
No, that is absolutely fundamental. We're not there typing it when fundamentally we're opposed to the concept that you can type these animals in the first place when they're not a recognized breed. And it's a very broad brush definition. We probably shouldn't get into XL bullies as a whole.
We could do a whole podcast on that, couldn't we? For a whole load of other people as well. Yeah. That's a good one, actually. We'd get a few people in, the Dogs Trust and BVA and a few others, and talk about XL bullies as one episode. So you talk a lot about change and advocating for change. What hasn't changed in your 30-year career? You know, what do you like? What stayed consistent? Is there anything that you sort of went to vet school thinking or feeling and wanting to do? And you still do it in the same way now? And you think, God, that hasn't changed at all. And I'm really pleased it hasn't.
I think you just have to remind yourself sometimes just the huge inherent value of the job that we do, what it means to our clients, to how much their animals mean to them, whatever they are, doesn't matter whether you're dealing with farm animals, what they mean, horses as athletes or pets, and just what you bring to people. Sometimes I think it's easy to become a bit numb to that after doing this job for 15, 30 years. It's good to take a step back. I enjoy people fundamentally, and the kind of client relationships, consult skills, that's what I particularly enjoy.
No, I'm glad you said that. I find that it's the people side of it that I love. And I think sometimes we're really bad at stewing on the one or two people in a week that complained or moaned about something and forgetting that, you know, you might see 20 people a day and everyone else was perfectly happy with what you did, very grateful for your help. And they actually, one thing I've discovered now I've got involved in sort of activities outside of the veterinary profession, because for a long time I only worked within the veterinary profession, but people really like vets. They really appreciate what they do. People don't really have a bad word to say about them. And you forget that when you're sort of on the front line, sometimes dealing with complaints and problems, that the huge majority of the population are very grateful for what we do. They love their animals. They love their vets. And even people who don't have animals still think vets are doing a good job.
Yeah, and I think as vets, we do recognize that. It's just very easy sometimes to be in that sort of negative echo chamber of hearing about clients who do complain, or where it hits the press, sort of negative press. When BVA asked members, how do you know we rate public respect? It's actually better than we might imagine. Over half of vets say it's either good, very good, or excellent. So I think it's really easy for us sometimes to be kind of a bit traumatized by some of the negative and just forget how much we bring to people and their animals and just the kind of day-to-day joy. You know, honestly, I sometimes have to stop and think about how important people's animals are. It sounds a bit cheesy, but, you know, that's really what brings a lot of value to being a vet, I think.
Yeah, it's a privilege, isn't it? And, you know, the fact that you get paid to, you know, interact with puppies or foals or calves, you know, I mean, it's some part of your day job, you know, it becomes routine, but actually it's quite a cool thing. You know, most people don't get to see a puppy that often, actually, do they?
Well, as a horse vet, I would never really do that, but it almost doesn't matter what the animal is. It's the inherent value to people and what you can bring to that.
That's a nice note to end on. About what a privilege it is to be a vet and what a positive impact we have on society. So thank you for your time, Malcolm. I really appreciate that.
Not at all. It's a great chat.
I'm sure we will do another one of these with you about another subject very soon.